This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
And it will be led by a new person for me to introduce to you, our community breakfast regulars, Professor Stacy Floyd Thomas. Professor Floyd Thomas came to us just this year from Bright Divinity School at Texas Christian University. She is a graduate of Vassar College, Candler School of Theology, and Temple University, where she earned her PhD. Her field is social ethics and womanist, feminist specialties therein. Please welcome to the podium Professor Stacy Floyd Thomas.
Good morning. The title of our collaborative presentation this morning is I Found God in Myself and Loved Her Fiercely, Black Women's Literary Analysis as a Source for Constructive Womanist Ethics. And this is done in collaboration with my class under the same title, Womanist Literature as a Resource for Womanist Ethics. So in celebration of Women's Month, after coming off of the climax of the inauguration and Black History Month, we see this as a synthesis and an opportunity to celebrate Black womanhood and what it might offer to the realm of theological education, religious studies discourse. And what follows is an exploration of an interdisciplinary approach to Christian ethics that is wedded to a thoroughgoing analysis of race, class, and gender oppression, better known as womanist literature as a resource for ethics. Briefly defined, womanism is a burgeoning discourse within religious studies and theological education that is accountable to the lived realities and practices of Black women by providing theories and methodologies that seek to unmask, debunk, and disentangle the interlocking forces of racism, sexism, and classism. In order to have you engage and experience the four tenets of womanist ethics, student ethicists from my class in womanist literature and ethics are here to offer poetic expressions of the four tenets of womanist ethics, namely radical subjectivity, traditional communalism, redemptive self-love, and critical engagement. These poetic testimonies, term tenets, term theories, and methodologies have been used to revise our understanding of the moral formation of Black women's writings. Black women's writings as sacred texts in their own right for constructive ethics that in turn can affect a canonical transformation within the guilds of literary criticism and ethics, and even within the dark phrases of womanhood.
Dark phrases of womanhood, of having never been a girl. Half notes scattered without rhythm, no tune. Distraught laughter falling over a Black girl's shoulders. It's funny. It's hysterical. The melodylessness of her dance. Shh. Don't tell nobody. Don't tell a soul. She's dancing on beer cans and shingles. This must be a spook house. Another song, no singers. Lyrics, no voices, and interrupted solos. Unseen performances. Are we ghouls? Children of horror? The joke? Shh. Don't tell nobody. Don't tell a soul. Are we animals? Have we gone crazy? I can't hear anything but the soft screams of death and the silence of death. And you promised me, somebody, anybody, sing a Black girl's song. Bring her out to know herself, to know you, but sing her rhythms. Karen, struggle and hard times. Sing her life. She's been dead so long. Closed in silence so long. She doesn't know the sound of her own voice. Her infinite beauty. She's half note scattered, without rhythm, no tune. Sing her sighs. Sing her possibilities. Sing a righteous gospel. Let her be known. Let her be known and handled warmly.
At an early age, I developed an interest in a complex relationship between norms and actions. Although I had neither the scholarly language of ethics nor the axiological framework of qualitative research necessary to structure my observations at the time, I was always intrigued to find that the relationship between the theological, quasi-spiritual preaching of many ministers and church leaders, those who had arguably been called by God, and the actual practices of those self-same purveyors of the Word of God were not in perfect accord. As I grew older and more aware, it amazed me to discover that Jesus, if the actions of my elders were any indication, did not, in fact, love all the little children of the world, red, yellow, black, and white, despite what I had been taught in word and song. Thus, as a child, I reasoned that if Jesus was a perfect expression of the absolute truths of the universe, then my spiritual guides and their love of Jesus and thereby their quest to please God by preaching God's word would also live according to the life that Jesus led. Herein lay the fallacy of my moral reasoning at the time. I had assumed, as only a child would, that preaching would dictate practice and thoughts would dictate action. And it was this theoethical wrestling that marked the beginning of my quest to answer the ethicist's supreme query. Why do people do what they do? I realized that what I saw differed fundamentally from the precepts which I had been inculcated. What I saw throughout my childhood in Corpus Christi, Texas, also known as the Body of Christ, was racial distrust. Equally, I saw the perpetuation of sexist stereotypes. I saw the oppression of disadvantaged people by the dominant privileged class. At an early age, I also saw people of one so-called minority group turn against other oppressed people, disavowing any commonalities between black and brown, any shared history, yet claiming the same spiritual strivings, yet worshiping the same white God. At an early age, my rites of passage as a young black Christian woman was marked by being disappointed by my own local congregation's refusal to include persons who did not fit the community's norm of being religious, while at the same time professing Christianity, which I was told was an inclusive gospel. I bore witness to the rejection of the unwed mother, the unchurched sinner, and the uneducated fool. All who were rejected because they could not comfortably assimilate into my middle-class black Baptist environment by the normative standards of that institution. What I saw as perhaps the most single damning thing in my youthful eyes was a tragedy of internalized oppression among black folk by those who did not archetype the norm. Thus, from early on, I was plagued by these contradictions. My childhood interrogation, how could so-called Christians behave as if God never existed, became further problematized in my intellectual and theological formation as I turned over and over in my mind the question, is there a qualitative nature to oppression? How can those who have been most oppressed preach, teach, and act out on an intense hate and fear and loathing of others? Where is the love of God in the suffering facing the least of these? Prompted by these and countless other questions, my cognitive dissonance sparked in me an embodied desire to explore the complex subjectivity of black womanhood. Long before womanism came into existence as either a term birthed by the pen and the imaginative prose of Alice Walker in 1983, or as an academic movement of black women introduced to the American Academy of Religion and the Society of Biblical Literature in 1985, There was, in my young mind, a mysterious and fascinating quality about what it meant to be black and female in the United States. And I wanted to figure it out.
Ever since I heard somebody called the colored girl an evil woman, a nag, or a bitch, I ain't been trying to be that, leaving bitterness in somebody else's cup. Because I want somebody to love me without deep and smelling scars from lie. Being left screaming in the street full of lunatics. Bitch, nigga, get out of here with all of that. I didn't bring you that. I brought you what joy I found. And I found joy. Honest fingers round my face. Dead musicians from Cuba. And live musicians from Chicago. And I ain't never been there. And I love Willie Colon and Arsenio Rodriguez. Especially when I can make the music loud enough where I can dance. And there's no me. Sir, gotta get off that floor because I get tired. And then there's that woman. That woman who hurts you. That woman who you left 3 or 4 times. And then having to leave me in the bottom of your shoe. You walk back where you hurt and I didn't have nothing. So I went with somebody who had something for me. And it wasn't you. I was coming back from her house in the bottom of your shoe. So this here, this ain't a love poem. Because there's only one more albums left. But this is a recommend for myself, because I have died in a real way. Yes, this here is a real dead loving for you now. And I don't know anymore. I don't know how to avoid my face with my tears. I didn't convince myself colored girls had no right to sorrow. And I lived and loved that way. And I left sorrow on the curb, allegedly for you, because I know I really did it for myself. I couldn't stand it. Couldn't stand being colored and sorry all at the same time. It's so redundant in the modern world.
This task to wrest black women's experience and existentialism from the juggernaut of modernity was especially complicated because it was trying to find critical and comprehensive resources of black women who were speaking of themselves as well as for themselves. But when I began reading short stories, novels, poems, and essays by black women sharing their views on race and racism, sexism, politics, romance, dreams deferred, love lost, education, faith and religion, fear, strength, despair, and hope, I was captivated by how they were able to express their personal experiences that shaped their worldviews and defined their lives. Although their views were varied, their voices could be brilliantly challenging and starkly individual based on the lived experiences that a given woman was ready, willing, and able to share with the world. A great paradox began to unfold the more I grappled with black women's literary production. With every sentence, they undermined stereotypes while uplifting an archetype of what it means to be a black woman. On the one hand, black women's realities as high school dropout, college professor, theologian or writer, as wife, divorcee, lover, mother, daughter, straight and lesbian, as a child of urban poverty or a product of the black bourgeoisie, a prolific professional author or a woman who never dared dream of publication, an isolated individuality or committed member of a movement, a gentle revolutionary or fierce believer. As revealed in these writings, a black woman can be sacred and profane. Astute and abstract, tender while being angry, loving and desperate simultaneously and without contradiction. Transcending the tyranny of stereotypes, black women's literature reveals the multiplicity of women's lives that are proudly black, female, beautiful, but burdened by blessings. From an early age, it was a work such as Anishinaabe Shage's For Colored Girls Who Had Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Was Enough, the choreo poem for which you're hearing excerpts this morning, that helped me understand the nuances of my embodied reality beyond the academic trends of postmodern identity politics, particularities, and political correctness. Illuminated by preaching that prided itself on rightly dividing the word of truth from sacred texts and about social practices, this notion of ethical contradiction was a warning signal to me of a thinking, being, doing dichotomy. This is a situation in which the marginalized, namely black women who wrestle with notions of theodicy while being imprisoned by a colonizing religion. Many liberation theologians and womanist ethicists alike have noted that unlike Isis, the goddess of Africa, or the black and beautiful beloved denoted in the biblical Song of Songs, black women's real life experiences in particular illustrate an American nightmare caused by colonizing religion. A salient example of this can be found in Alice Walker's novel, The Color Purple. Herein, Celie, the confused Christian who was taught to worship a god that's a big, white, old, bearded, barefooted man with cool, bluish gray eyes. She finds herself wanting more and ends up disavowing a god to whom she once bared her soul. In a letter to her sister, Nettie, she writes, quote, "I don't write to God no more. I write you. What happened to God?" asked Shug. "Who that?" I say. She looked at me real serious. "Big a devil as you is," I say, "you ain't worried about no God, surely." She said, "Wait a minute, just hold a minute there. Just cause us don't harass it like some people says no, don't mean I ain't got no religion. What God do for me?" Celie asked. She said, "Celie," like she shocked, "he gave you life, good health, and one that love you to death." "Yeah," Celie say. "And he gave me a lynch daddy, a crazy mama, a low-down dog of a stepaw, and a sister I probably won't ever see again. Anyhow," Celie say, "the God I've been praying to and writing to is a man, and act like all the other menses I know, trifling, forgetful, and low-down." She say, "Miss Celie, you better hush. God might hear you. Let him hear me," I say. If he ever listened to poor colored women, the world would be a different place. Here in this state of existential angst and eschatological hope, black women's insistence of making a way out of no way, lifting as they climb, hitting a straight lick with a crooked stick, and pressing on the upward way, represents a moral wisdom, yet spiritual fortitude of those who've been rendered silent and invisible in the task of normative theological ethics. Those women who are deemed little more than three-fifths human are never afforded the status of being a responsible self in the normative ethical gazes of the H. Richard Niebuhr. Niebuhr, recall, presumes that the responsible self as a moral agent has a power and autonomy to exercise freedom in relating to God and neighbor. This, of course, represents a type of agency unavailable to everyday black women because she has neither the power nor social regard with which to engage man or God. Her experience of what it means to be a human is thus denied. The black woman's experience of what it means to be an embodied human exposes John Rawls's classic theory of justice as an absurdity because it disregards the envisioning of a justice for human beings who are actually embodied people who possess different bodies, different than his own. This moral reflective weakness is not exclusive to scholars alone. Even everyday black women are mystified by everyday well-intentioned and God-fearing people who claim to see the humanity in everyone, yet they are frequently mystified by gender, class, and race ideologies and discourses that either render them subhuman or invisible, or at best, they offer theories and theologies that are little more than a thin veneer of apologetics and social regrets.
One thing I don't need, any more apologies. I got sorry greeting me on my front door. You can keep yours. I don't know what to do with them. They don't open doors. They don't bring the sun back. They don't make me happy or get a morning paper. Didn't nobody stop me from using my tears to wash cars because of sorry. I am simply tired of collecting. I didn't know I was so important to you. I'm gonna have to throw some away. I can't get to the clothes in my closet because of sorry. I'm gonna tack a sign by the door, leave a message by the phone. You call to say you're sorry, call somebody else. I can't use them anymore. I let sorry and didn't mean to, and how could I know about that? Take a walk down a dark and musty street in Brooklyn. I'm gonna do exactly what I wanna do. Won't be sorry for none of it. Let sorry soothe your soul. I'm gonna soothe mine. You were always inconsistent. Doing something and then being sorry. Beating my heart to death because of sorry. Well, I will not call. I'm not going to be nice. I will raise my voice and scream and holler and break things and race the engine. And I will tell all of your secrets about yourself to your face. And I won't be sorry for none of it. I loved you. I loved you on purpose. I was open on purpose. And I still crave vulnerability and close talk. And I'm not even sorry about you being sorry. You can carry all the guilt and grime you wanna. Just don't give it to me. I can't use it anymore. Next time, you should just admit you're mean, low-down, trifling, and no-count straight out. Instead of being sorry all the time, enjoy being yourself.
Howard Thurman reminds us as clergy, students of Christian faith, or teachers of theological education, that the true measure of our vocation is in our ability to answer the question, what then is the word of the religion of Jesus to those whose backs stand against the wall? There must be the clearest possible understanding of the anatomy of the issues facing them. They must recognize fear, deception, hatred, each for what it is. Once having done this, they will become increasingly clear that the contradictions of life are not ultimate. The disinherited will know for themselves that there is a spirit at work in life and in the hearts of human beings which is committed to overcoming the world. Faced with Thurman's assertion, I find it fruitful to think about how deeply intertwined Black women's lives are to the fate of all people. What do we do with the disinherited of our world? Nation, state, cities, communities, schools, and homes. How can we decenter ourselves from our privileged positions of comfort while simultaneously placing at the center of our thoughts and actions the constructive envisioning offered to us by the marginalized groups among us? Herein lies the crux of my paramount concern as a scholar activist, and what I hope is an urgent question for those of us who dare to imagine that cultivating an ethic of freedom should be one of the most urgent concerns facing the academy and the church today. But the heart of the problem that we face in this regard is not the aesthetic or ideal image of God, making God a raced, sex, embodied entity, but rather seeing in every being's race, sex, gender, and class a voice and a presence of God that needs to be heard and seen. The moral crisis of identity within both the church and society, occasioned by the unending violence, discrimination, poverty, hatred, and terror, is expressed by the fear that we may worship a strange God who is blind to gender, class, and color, and neither shares nor sees our interests, concerns, or thoughts. By exploring and evaluating Black women's literature, especially in terms of its ethos, pathos, logos, and theos, in other words, the artistry of its values, passion, intelligence, and spirituality, there is a confrontation of the human condition from the perspective of Black women whose exigent circumstances are too often downplayed and degraded in a society that is at once racist, sexist, and classist. These testaments turn normative ethics on its head as it reveals that there is nothing virtuous that espouses suffering and frugality as religious ideals. There is nothing profitable in a discourse or faith tradition wherein one must lose their soul, prostitute their culture, numb up and dumb down in order to secure a place in the world.
Somebody almost walked off with all of my stuff. Not a poem or a dance I gave up in the street, but somebody almost walked off with all of my stuff. Like a kleptomaniac working hard and forgetting while stealing. This ain't your stuff. Now won't you put me back and let me hang out with my own self. Somebody almost walked off with all of my stuff and didn't care enough to send a note home saying I was late for my solo conversation or two sizes too small for my own tacky skirts. What can you do with something of no value on an open market? Did you get a dime for my payment? Where you going with all my stuff? This is a woman's trip, and I need my things to ooh and to out about.
Daddy, I got a mainline number for my own stuff. Now, won't you put me back and let me play this duet solo? Honest to God, somebody almost walked off with all of my stuff and didn't bring nothing but the kick and the sway of it. The perfect body for my man, and ain't none of it theirs. This is mine. Shauna, her own things. Now give me my stuff. I want my rhythms and my voice. So why don't you open my mouth and let me talk you out of throwing my stuff in the sewer? I need my things. This is some delicate leg and whimsical kiss. I gotta have to get to my choice without you running off with all my stuff. Now, you can't have me unless I give me away. And I was doing all that till you run off on a good thing. Who's this you left me with? Some simple chick with a bad attitude? I want my things. I want my arm with a hot iron scar and my calloused feet. And I want my quick language back in my mouth. Fried plantains and sunrise and Joseph and Jules. And I want my things, how I live them. I want my memories, how I was when I was there. You can't have them or do nothing with them. And stealing my stuff from me don't make it yours. Makes it stolen. Somebody almost run off with all of my stuff. And the thing about it is, I was standing here the whole time looking at myself. And while the spirit that took my stuff was a man who ran off with my stuff, a man faster than my innocence, was a lover I made too much room for. And I didn't know I'd give it up so quick. And the one running with it don't know we got it. And I'm standing here shouting, this is mine! And he don't know we got it. My stuff is the anonymous ripped-off treasure of the year. Did you know somebody almost got away with me? Me in a plastic bag underneath their arms. Me dangling from a string of personal carelessness. I'm splattered with rain and city mud. And no, I didn't have a chance to prep before I left. Hey man, where you going with all my stuff? This is not your prerogative. I gotta have me in my pocket to get around like a good woman should. To make the poem in the pot or the chicken in the dance, what I got to do, I gotta have me to do it. Now, why don't you find your own things and leave this package for my destiny? What you gotta get from me, I'll give it to you. Yeah, I'll give it to you. From 5 o'clock in the winter, when the sun is blue-red and Dew City is crest. Yeah, I'll give it to you. If it's really my stuff, you gotta give it to me. If you really want it, I'm the only one who can handle it.
It is a task of Christian social womanist ethics to divest these spiritually bankrupt theological projects of cultural ripoff and appropriation of Black women by decolonizing the spirit of Christian moral agency. We might begin this task by exploring, to quote Alice Walker, what would it feel like not to be imprisoned by the hatred of women, the love of violence, and the destructiveness of racism and greed. Central to the womanist ethical agenda is to find moral means by which we as scholars of religion, theological educators, clergy, and the laity can overcome the various forms of alienation socially, culturally, physically, and geographically that have invariably kept women like Celie or any other women in these poems from realizing a positive sense of religious awareness within themselves as well as within the company of others. Put another way, we develop theories and methods that seek to redeem and restore the field of normative theological ethics in a practical way. We thus make it possible for the teaching of theological education and the preaching of an unadulterated liberating gospel to race forward and engender a justice that is responsible, relevant, and embodied in the ultimate concerns for us all. In particular, we seek to mine those rich and untapped motherlodes of moral wisdom as spoken through the mouths of and seen through the minds, hearts, and souls of Black women. Women whose epistemological privilege provides a worm's eye view of our world that can aid us in developing tools that can help generate knowledge designed to describe, analyze, and empower all oppressed people in order to change our dismal plights into perspective and positive life chances. Black women writers function as a continuing symbolic conveyors and transformers of the values acknowledged by the female members of the Black community. In the quest for appreciating Black women's experience, nothing surpasses the Black women's literary tradition. It cryptically records the specificity of life, not only within Black America, but within America writ large. The Black women's literary tradition is a valid source for understanding how ethical values may be created and cultivated in an individual or communal struggle for survival and empowerment. One may wonder why Black women's writing should be privileged as a site that represents Black reality when in fact it is regarded and names itself as fiction. Due to such a cognitive contradiction, one might beg the following questions. How can fiction reflect reality? And more particularly, why is it so important to analyze women's literature as a resource for constructive ethics? The true question, however, is if not Black women's literature, what sources can be utilized to find their greater truths of fortitude in the face of formidable odds? Living in our society, we are constantly bombarded by media images and vernacular that despises the reality of women of African descent until they're attached to white or male bodies. We cannot depend upon the interpretation of sacred texts and religious rhetoric that are still overwhelmingly misogynist, elitist, and white supremacist in its impact in all of our lives, but particularly those women of color who sit at the underside of history, but who have served as the sacrificial lambs to our overall prosperity and posterity. In light of the 1965 Moynihan Report and the numerous recent polls, surveys, and census reports that have marked the last quarter of a century, How can we trust such social research data that not only is politically motivated, but is also inundated with bias and flaws? In order to avoid this, the necessity to focus upon the writings of Black women serves as a means of giving voice to those who have been silenced by virtue of their social location, yet retain their righteous discontent, holy boldness, and socially relevant spiritual discernment. Without the luxury of fiction and fantasy, Black women's literature is rooted in the real lives and deeper truths of the most vulnerable and maligned children of God in this land. Womanists and Black feminists have long contended that Black women's writing should not be regarded as mere fiction, that is, art for art's sake, but rather as a research response to Black women's socioethical experiences in the face of the history of oppression. Womanist theologian Karen Baker Fletcher asserts this perspective when she states, and I quote, "Black women's literature is narrative, and narrative is essentially an interpretive construction of the perceptions of truth through myth and history," unquote. Black women's writing particularly represents the real life experiences of Black women's oppression, referred to by literary scholar Sandra Redding as a literature made out of necessity. Black women's literary tradition is utilitarian in nature because it provides a venue of expression to those communal voices that would otherwise be silenced or distorted within dominant representations and the perspectives of the realities of the Black community that these representations transmit as truth. This particular function of Black women's literary tradition renders it a critical resource for womanist ethics in as much as it foregrounds the moral exigencies and ethical perspectives of those severely disadvantaged by discrimination. This womanist assessment of Black women's writing as truth-telling is not a fortuitous recognition. On the contrary, Black women writers themselves have understood this as the primary intention in their writing. Listen to Zora Neale Hurston's words of Langston Hughes. Quote, "For I not only want to present the matter with all the life and color of my people, I want to leave no loopholes for the scientific crowd to rend and tear us. I'm leaving the story material almost untouched. I've only tampered with it where the storyteller was not clear. I know it's going to read different, but that is the glory of it, don't you think? Unquote. Black scholars have long attested to the importance of Black women's literature as a textual site that captures the experience of Black communal life. Black women religion scholars in particular have found in this tradition an inspiration for critical inquiry into the nature of institutional forms of domination, as bell hooks has observed, and I quote. Black women writers have been a courageous vanguard, effectively exploring various politics of domination, racism, sexism, and capitalism, and questioning institutions, religious and secular, that reinforce and uphold these structures. Their writing necessarily inspires Black women scholars attempting to create a new critical direction. Within theology, Black women scholars have been among the most willing to acknowledge the supportive influence, identifying it as one of many traditions shaping their theoretical perspectives, unquote. Womanist ethicists in particular have been the pioneers in their efforts to use Black women's literature as a source for shaping new theoretical perspectives, for gleaning ethical sources that reflect and enhance the reality of Black communal life. The progenitor of womanist ethics, Katie Cannon, has been the leader in culling from the Black women's literary texts the sacred values and the ethical norms reflective of the sociocultural practices within this community. She justifies using Black women's literary tradition as a privileged source for her own exploration of womanist ethics in what follows. Quote, the Black women's literary tradition delineates the many ways that ordinary Black women have fashioned value patterns and ethical procedures on their own terms, as well as mastering, transcending, radicalizing, and sometimes destroying pervasive negative orientations imposed by the mores of the larger society, unquote. Once Cannon opened this pathway in her work, other womanist theologians and ethicists followed suit. The womanist tradition and religion reorients the direction of Black women's scholarship within the academy as a vital source for ethics because it preserves much of the moral wisdom of Black folk culture and the survival ethic that has been transmitted not only through oral and oral tradition, but the survival culture and the improvisation that has built America. In examining Black women's literature as a repository of moral wisdom, wherein the female characters have subverted racist, sexist, and classist ideologies, or have internalized them, we may come to some understanding of the degree to which literature helps to record, imagine, and aid women in their journey towards moral agency. Black women's literary criticism and womanist ethics analysis of literary texts are analogous in as much as they both seek to correct damaging and dehumanizing stereotypes of Black women while celebrating the resilience of African-American culture in general and women's culture in particular. Yet although these orientations share a common vision in as much as they draw on Black women's writings as a source for articulating identity politics, Black feminist criticism emerged as a response to the radical writings of young Black women in the 60s and 70s who had begun to produce these works, foregrounded by the experience through space and time. These works, however, were deemed subversive. Both Black women writers and critics who highlighted their work were radical because either through fiction or criticism, they rewrote history and forced the American imagination to wrestle with the atrocities of American society, from enslavement to Jim and Jane Crow segregation, while at the same time celebrating the beauty and the power of Black culture as evidenced in the Harlem Renaissance, Civil Rights Movement, Black Power, and the Black Arts Movements that survived in spite of the effects of racist, sexist, and classist orders in American legacy. Black feminist literary critics have focused on ways in which these women writers deliberately shatter the stereotypes of Black women. By the mid-70s, Afro-American women fiction writers like Paula Marshall, Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Toni K. Bambara, and Gail Jones had not only defined their cultural context as a distinctly African-American one, but they had also probed many of the facts of the interrelationship of sexism and racism in their society. Not only had they demonstrated the fact that sexism existed in Black communities, but they also challenged the prevailing definition of woman in American society. Black feminist literary critics such as Barbara Christian helped to usher in a new literary criticism, one that showcased Black women's writings and placed them among the treasured work of American literature. But in contrast to the aforementioned goals of Black feminist literary criticism in particular, its reevaluation of the literary canon in its gendered, race, and class dimensions, The womanist ethical trajectory is not one that has literary criticism as its means or ends. Rather, womanist ethicists turn to literature in order to better call out the ultimate concern of women in their moral agency formation. Simply put, whereas literary criticism on Black women's writings is reflective of the ways that Black women writers understand and represent their social and historical realities and identity formation, womanist ethicists deem Black women's texts as constructive paradigms of moral wisdom. As woman scholar of religion Joy Brown states, the literary critic and the theologian play roles that are at once complementary and circular. In a sense, they are working with the same material, African-American culture and society, with all the complexities and idiosyncrasies born of a peculiar history in the United States. The African-American literary critic takes the text of the culture, be it literature, orature, or event, and decodes the content encoded in language, structure, style, and context, asking, what does this text really say to us? What does it not say? But the theologian, the ethicist, takes the same material and examines its content for issues of meaning and ultimate significance. What does this text really mean for my life? What does it imply about my humanity? But most importantly, what does it mean about God and how I am made in God's image? Womanist religious ethicists attend to Black women's writings as sacred texts because embedded within them is a strong tradition of charting the crux of Black women's spirituality vis-a-vis their persistent questioning of the Odyssey, their spiritual strivings, and their radically imminent conceptions of the design. From these sacred texts, womanist ethicists carve out a canonical repository of life stories that illuminate the experience of survival and liberation in the midst of evil and suffering. The womanist ethicist literary task attends to both the theological problem of evil and suffering and sin and the social problem of tripartite oppression as systemic injustice as one and the same. In this regard, womanist ethical literary methods provides exegetical analyses of Black women's sacred texts in order to render theoretical prescriptions for both social criticism and theological reflection. Moreover, and more significantly, womanist ethicists glean from these texts prophetic models of liberation enacted by the female characters as strategies of resistance for the purpose of addressing the questions of agency, relationships, and the quest for liberative action. Thus, Black women's writings serve as a valuable medium through which a womanist ethical center critique can be formed as an alternative to the marginalization resulting from the canonical, theological, and philosophical sources that are usually employed in normative Christian ethics. A womanist ethical analysis of literature is necessary in order to complete what the fields of literary criticism and normative Christian ethics have left undone, namely the creation of a knowledge base that carves out truths and meanings appropriate to our understanding of the best representation of human virtue and those who do embody it. A living gospel wherein all God's people can be seen as those who are fearfully and wonderfully made and made in God's image.
I was missing something. I was missing something. I was missing something. Something so important to me. Something promised.
A laying on of hands. Fingers near my forehead.
Strong.
Cool.
Sense making me whole.
Pure. All the gods coming into me, laying me open to myself.
I was missing something.
Something promised.
Something free. A laying on of hands.
I know about laying on bodies, laying out a man, but I was missing something.
A laying on of hands.
Not a man laying on.
Not even my mama's touch.
I sat up one night, walking a boarding house, screaming, crying, the ghost of another woman who was missing what I was missing. I wanted to jump up out of my bones to be done with myself. Leave me alone and go off into the wind. It was too much. I fell into numbness. Till the only tree I could see took me up in her branches and held me in the breeze and made me dawn dew, that chill at daybreak. The sun wrapped me up, swinging rose light everywhere. The sky lay over me like a million doves. I was cold. I was burning up. A child and endlessly weaving garments for the moon with my tears. I found God in myself. And I loved her. I loved her fiercely.
And this is for colored girls who have considered suicide but are moving to the ends of their own rainbows. Thank you.
Presentation, and I know that there might be some questions, and I realize at the same time that we're at the end of the formal breakfast hour, but if there are any questions that you might have of myself or the students in the class, we will be willing to entertain them.
Stacy, let's take about 5 minutes for any questions, but would you or ask your...
Oh, yes, so let me introduce...
Dean
had that one we call the cast. If you all would please stand, we have Clem Marie, who is a doctoral student in ethics, Sharizna, MDiv student, Phoebe, MDiv student and the president of our Black Seminarians Union, Shauna, who is also a senior MDiv student, as well as our student government moderator, Alusla, who is a senior.
First year,
as well as the intern for cultural production. And our other classmates in class, Cam, who is a senior, MDiv student, Bonnie, what year are you?
I'm a second year MTS.
Second year MTS. Josh, who's a senior MDiv student, and Chris Driscoll, who's a class intern. So, and they've studied and worked on this really hard. They're going to do a fuller production of the entire book this evening, I think.
Tonight at 7, right here in this room, is totally free.
So they've been walking in the motivation and in the agency of their characters. They literally are haunted and possessed by these women. They've done a wonderful job. And the reason why they've been committing to memorization and really working, you can see that the text really is bent, they've read it 50,000 times, is because these are new songs, right? How do you minister to women who are in prison because there are women who were in love, right? When we talk about the prison industrial system and the growing number of women, of black women who are really the target, we've been talking about black men as a target, and truly they are, but the growing numbers in the prison industrial system, as well as those who are contracting HIV/AIDS, are black women. And not because these are women who want to be criminals or women who want to be promiscuous, but these are women who are in trouble because they're women who are in love. And does the Psalm of David, right, written in King's English, right, or Shakespearean English, really work to address these women's needs? It's important that our ministers listen to music and literature of marginalized people in order to hear those as contemporary songs. Songs and pleas to God for accountability, for intervention, right? For presence in the midst of sorrow. So they have been looking at them truly as sacred texts, right? This is not, we're not looking at literature in order to do a theoretical analysis of pop culture. No. We're really doing exegetical examination of black women's writings as sacred. What does it mean to live? I mean, when we read the Hebrew Bible, we're reading what it means to live in the fear of domination and having one's culture taken away from them, broken covenants, right? That's what we realize today that we have in black women's literature. And many people have said, well, don't you have, why doesn't film work in the same way? Why doesn't music? In all of those other realms, public realms, black women's images and their resources are controlled by a white male imagination. What does it mean when Vogue magazine calls RuPaul the prettiest black woman in America? What does it mean when the black movies that actually get more money from white America as well as black America are those that have black men cross-dressing and making fun of the strongest matriarch within the black community? So where do we go to hear the black woman's voice, right? And we go there when we look at these texts, because truly a feminist and a womanist analysis will say that the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, right? So there is a role in which women are the cultural purveyors of the privatization and the formation of our personal identities. And if black women since 1965, obviously from the legacy of chattel slavery and the like, but when public policy has us skewing our imagination to where we see black women instantly as welfare queens, when in fact, if we were to look statistically at what a real welfare queen was, it would be a white Appalachian woman, right? But our distorted images of not knowing who these women are and really needing a resource to go to in order to tap those resources, not only for a positive identity formation of these women, but really to save our culture and our society, which women do possess and others. Any questions? Any questions for the class, for the students who did a wonderful performance, I think? I'm really proud of them.
You all will get all A's.
Yeah. Tonight we'll tell. They haven't passed so far. Any questions?
Well, just a comment to thank you all. It was such a powerful and meaningful experience to be here. And perhaps you all should take a term's leave of absence and take this throughout the community, to high schools, to prisons, to congregations, to hear these voices, to hear it. It was beautifully done.
Thank you.
Well, Dan's comment, I think, is excellent, excellent practices suggestion that bridges the academy and church.
Yeah.
But to pinpoint how important and significant it is, we have diversity at American Baptist College. We have a white male who's in a student role, and he's reacting to the persons we have having coming to the symposium next week in terms of strengthening black families, sound agenda, homiletics, and he's reading the works of the authors, the scholars who come from Mother Lode and others. And his essay to the professor is tantamount to the violence and hostility of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And he is not ashamed in writing that to the professor in a way that we had to have a meeting with him, calling black womanism nothing but black woman is hate. Mm. And that is in the image of white male patriarchy, of course. Yeah. But it's in my student body at American Baptist College. In its rawest form, the point that I'm concerned about this student. And not old, young enough to have had alternative visions, but steeped enough in the racist structures and hegemony of a culture that has passed on images of black life and black womanhood, that he thinks he can be up in that, talking like that, and not ashamed.
Well, the infantilization of women is nothing new. And the way that we have it within churches preach appalling gospel that say that women and children should be present but not heard is real. And as students in the womanist ethics class have learned, institutional sexism works in such a way that when you show up and you express yourself alone, let alone pushing against the parameters of institutional sexism, you're automatically maligned, right? I mean, automatically maligned. And I've been tickled all morning because sitting at your table is Blanche Cook, and I haven't seen her for over 20 years. We were colleagues at Vassar College together, and several of us, we didn't have classes, even at Vassar, a historically women's school, on black feminism, let alone womanism at that time. And many of us, she was our guru, our resident guru, would get together and read black feminism on our own, in each other's rooms, read black women's literature. And these same women, we were just reminiscing about it now, are ethicists. Blanche does legislative, she's a resident lawyer, legislative advocacy around criminal justice. Another of our colleagues is working within Hillary Clinton's cabinet when she was a senator in New York. Another one, a filmmaker in Harlem. These women, because of those experiences, right? Not because of what we were learning in women's studies, that was about white women, but because of those concealed gatherings, reading black women's texts for ourselves, as we were within a context that was supposedly for women, but had no positive reflections of us as black women, right? And when you look at black professional women, for instance, black professional women had the highest level of chronic diseases, sexually transmitted diseases, mental instability, because of trying to imagine themselves and negotiate having voice and competence, right, in the comforts of an ivory tower, and having no theory, no method, no way to be more than just a token, but actually galvanize some type of power to make a difference and change. So you all have been a wonderful audience. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for your support. Please do come tonight to see this wonderful group do an artistic performance. Thank you. Thank you.